Welcome. This is Christopher Holmes, and this is a two-hour slot of Zero Point Radio and Zero Point Teachings. We explore a wide range of mystical, esoteric, and spiritual subjects, as well as explorations in modern science and commentary on the social life of humankind. My name's Christopher Holmes. I have a website at www.zeropoint.ca. I invite you to view my website, and I have 6 books available based on different aspects of my 30 years of mystical esoteric studies. I have several books on the Gurdjieff Uspensky teaching, and then I have a series called Within, Without, From Zero Points, dealing with mystical views of consciousness and creation. And then I have another book, most recently, God, Science, and the Secret Doctrine, which explains the relationship of Blavatsky's archaic metaphysics to modern ideas in physics and cosmology. You can see aspects of my book up on my site, and I've put some writings up there, even though they're earlier editions, and I haven't worked at my website for a while. But still, there's a lot of articles on the site, and my books are available from there. In the background, I have James Moffat. Jim, welcome.
Hello. Thank you.
Jim, I'm in Ottawa, Ontario. Jim's in Toronto, Ontario. And BBS is broadcast out in Northern California, but I guess available around the world. So I hope we have some listeners from around the globe. How are you, Jim? How's it?
I'm well, thank you.
Yeah,
I was just thinking, wow, 6 books, that's a lot of books. There's a lot of material in these 6 books, too, that people should definitely explore your website and familiarize themselves with some selections of your writings. They're very, very interesting material with far-reaching implications for issues in science and spirituality, nature of consciousness, nature of soul, nature of God, pretty much everything under the sun. I was thinking, Chris has 6 books, and I've written 4 books, but one of them was about a drunken lawyer and a cat, so I don't know if that would count.
That counts, too.
I was visiting the Templeton Foundation website the other day, looking at their granting applications, and they've just revised it recently. And, you know, the Templeton Foundation is Sir John Templeton. I think he's a sir. I think he's knighted. Anyway, John Templeton, who's an international financier, Templeton Mutual Funds is his organization. But he has a very strong interest in religious and spiritual matters. And he has a foundation which grants a considerable amount of money to people who further progress in research and our understanding of the nature of spirituality and religion and how it pertains to modern life. And Charles Taylor, a Canadian philosopher, won, $1 million prize last year. And I was, you know, just looking at the mission statement of the foundation and everything, I thought, boy, at some point I hope that somebody at the Templeton Foundation has a chance to review your work in detail, because given their mission statement, I think that your work really would qualify for some sort of recognition by them. And
I would like to find some support for my work somewhere.
Yeah,
I know in the 3 to 4 years now, I've had my website and tried to solicit donations through that. I've only ever received $15 donation in that period of time. I've had other donations from some friends, you know, they helped me go to California this summer, and yourself and another friend in Ottawa. But yeah, I kind of struggle to find support for the kind of work I do. And it's funny, because I'm a mystical psychologist, and, you know, I look around, I'd most like to have a teaching position, perhaps, in the university at one point. But if I look around, where do they have any esoteric or mystical spiritual psychologies? And there's nothing offered. Like, there's no place within the educational system for the most important area of human investigation, which is into the nature of self and the nature of consciousness within ourself, and whether we have a spirit or soul nature or whether we're simply material biological beings. And in the whole of the modern educational system and all the psychology departments, you have almost no exploration of the whole area of psychology as a science of the soul or how to develop consciousness within ourselves. So it's this huge lack in the modern educational system. It's funny how my work's always fallen outside of the mainstream enough and still does today, even though I guess, I've had some broader exposure now through my work.
Yeah, well, that was partly what I was reacting to when I was on the Templeton website. I realized that even with their mandate, and it's really quite an inspiring mission statement, and their interests are certainly, I think, very laudable. And I realize that in a sense, your work kind of falls out of the mainstream, probably of their understanding of things too. And it's kind of frustrating in the sense that something so important, as you say, gets so little recognition and so little consideration, and yet, you know, in a way, has such profound implications for the way that we understand ourselves and see ourselves. I was rereading Margaret Wertheim's book, Pythagoras' Trousers, about the history of science and religion. And at the beginning, she says that, you know, in most cultures, mythology and religion provide people with their world picture, the picture with which they represent the nature of reality to themselves. But now, it's in modern post-technological societies, it's science. And even in saying that, it's like she means a very specific time, kind of materialist, reductionist science with no psychology or soul or religious
yeah.
or animistic or metaphysical principles attached there too. And it's a shame in a sense because it's really only in the last couple of hundred years that this worldview has developed, and it's taken over things to the point that you have a guy like Richard Dawkins who has a bestseller with a book called The God Delusion. And, you know, with all due respect to Richard Dawkins, he's a very prominent scientist. I think he's quite deluded about God, and I don't think he really has very much. I would say he has a very simplistic and quite idiotic understanding of the nature of religion and God. It's like some of the targets he attacks are, in terms of fundamentalist views, I agree with him that these things are reprehensible and that they don't represent true spirituality or religion, but it's like throwing the baby out with the bathwater.
It's funny, the way I see it, it's like in the contemporary debate between religion and science is, firstly, people don't understand what religion is because they only understand religions in their exoteric or outer form.
Precisely.
So they all have different names and different practices, and so they see religions as sources of conflict between people. But they don't have an understanding of the esoteric or the hidden side of the religious teachings, which deal with the science of consciousness, the nature of the soul and spirit, and so on. So when people debate science and religion, firstly, they have a fanciful idea of what religion is and don't understand that. And then their idea of science, what that is also pseudo-scientific. It's not that there's anything wrong with the facts of science, but the simplistic kind of materialist interpretation of the facts of science is really quite fraudulent. In that, firstly, we make all these assumptions about the brain producing consciousness and thinking we understand consciousness and the mind, but really there's fundamental errors and gaps in our understanding. And then you have whole areas of paranormal research showing different experiences human beings can have and different evidences, anecdotal evidences that show the kind of complex interrelatedness between events of subtle dimensions of being, like when coincidental things happen and the structure of coincidental things. If you want to try to understand like the physics of a more complex worldview, you have to go beyond that kind of simplistic materialist science. philosophy. So generally, when I hear people debate religion and science, my feeling is, well, they don't understand what religion is, and they have a mistaken idea of what science is. And really, it's, in my view, it's only if you come to mystical science that you can take the, you know, the positive aspects of both approaches. Like, we can take the methods of science and the findings of science, but we view them in a deeper interpretive framework. And so there is this mystical science, which is science which not only deals with what people think is a simple material reality, but it's science which deals with the material reality, but then also the subtle interdimensional processes which sustain and create that material reality. Because reality is multidimensional, and human beings do have multidimensional existence. So we need an understanding of how these things could be possible. If there are afterlife worlds, there has to be a physics to it. There has to be, because it's, if there's afterlife worlds, they're composed of some types of substances or some energies or intelligences. So there has to be a physics of that and a metaphysics of that. So I say we need to take the approach of science and the findings of science, but have a deeper interpretive understanding. And, you know, I think the ideas are there that we can understand how existence can be multidimensional. The ideas are there now in modern physics.
Yeah, I think that's very well stated. I mean, I completely agree with you in terms of I see, the more I read about the history of this alleged conflict between science and religion, the more I see how it's such a, how that view is such a skewed and overdrawn interpretation of the history of science and the history of religion, and focuses on there's a lot of mythological aspects to it that just really don't fit with the facts whatsoever, and that the conflict between religion and science is much more of a socio-political, economic, historical matter, which is, it deals with both theological issues and scientific issues, but really it is rooted in human activity, and you really have to understand the whole context in which this has occurred. And it's really, as you say, it's a certain type of religion, a certain understanding of religion, and a certain understanding of science that are in conflict. But once you go beyond that, there's nothing inherently existing between the two that really rules out some sort of integration and some sort of further understanding based on both science and religion. I would say, as you said, that we really need to come to this deeper understanding of the multidimensional nature of reality and the multidimensional nature of human beings, and that would have all sorts of implications for understanding ourselves and understanding the universe, and in very practical ways too, in terms of medicine and in terms of education. There are a variety of fundamental issues that could be seriously reconstrued and reconceived in an entirely new light if we came.
Yeah,
to that
you could have a whole different media, like educational media, instead of a media that all intentionally like deludes people, deceives people.
Well, it's like, you know, and right now in the province of Ontario, we have this we have an election coming up, provincial election, and one of the issues is to whether or not funding should be extended to separate schools in terms of religious education. And you know, there are those who say that we should abolish all religious education, that we shouldn't have Catholic or Jewish schools, and we should not have Muslim schools. That's one of the contentious issues. And then there are other people who say, well, you know, if people want to educate their children and bring them up in a religious atmosphere, that's their right, you know, and the question is who's going to pay for it. But like, I kind of see like the whole debate in a way is kind of, well, it depends on what you mean by religion. First of all, I mean, I think religion should be taught in all schools, but the way it's taught is so superficial, and as you pointed out earlier, it's based on this idea that there are all these different conflicting viewpoints between different religions. But religion means to, in the root, the word means to unite, and there's an esoteric basis to all this, and that's what's kind of missing from the from the debate about religion. And the other thing I was just going to say was, the other thing is that it's like the Gurdjieff makes a distinction about in religions between the teaching of what to believe and how to believe it. I mean, what's lost in the most of the West, of the major religions, I would say, is the instrumental aspect. There's no yoga to it. There's no concern with how we should learn to study ourselves and the world in order to be able to practice a religion. And that's the other side of it all, I guess.
And I mean, then there's, I mean, if you look at, like, what religion is in our society, I mean, it's shocking. I mean, here you have all these religious these churches, and where in any of the churches is anyone speaking the truth of 9/11 or objecting to the mass murders being conducted around the planet or objecting to the emergence of this totalitarian regime in our society? Where are the churches? They're all silent. Or no, they're not silent. They call the religious right, and what these people need their head examined. Yeah. Here they are supportive of mass murdering of foreign people for, you know, oil and military power and things like this. And they're supportive of that, and they call themselves Christian.
Yeah, in general.
Like, if you look at what's become of the churches in the world, I mean, it's complete hypocrisy. Where are the churches standing up and objecting on a moral basis to what's being done internationally? They're nowhere. They're cowards. In fact, they're part of the very same elite and these same patterns of corruption and perversion and all this. You know, it's a completely false church. I know of no church has come out with the truth of 9/11, and these things are known in the upper echelon of all the churches. They have to be, unless they're all complete idiots.
I think you have to consider that latter possibility. I don't know that they do know this. I mean, if you speak to people about 9/11 and raise the possibility that there is a skullduggery afoot there, that there was some sort of participation by the American government, either tacitly or actively, you get very peculiar reactions from people. A lot of people. Somebody was telling me the other day, he was talking with his wife about this, and he's skeptical about the official version, and is kind of open to, you know, trying to understand the issues involved. But he said, you know, his wife's point of view is that she just can't believe that that would happen.
Yeah, well,
I think that's you know, realistic. I think that most people just, unfortunately, it leads people to just dismiss what they don't, you know, that they don't haven't really examined. It's always the same thing as, you know, anybody kind of challenges the, you know, conventional interpretation or representation of any socio-political fact, and, you know, you're labeled as an extremist or a conspiracy nut. But, you know, unfortunately, in the 9/11 case, there's a lot of conspiracy nuts out there, you know, and I'm one of them. So, that is the reaction of a lot of people. I'm not sure
it's a complex subject. I mean, I've heard of polls in New York City, where over half the population thinks there's questions and would like
the whole
thing reopened. And I mean, there's huge numbers of people. I think there are very few people who put two and two together and get four and kind of start realizing, oh, yes, this does mean that it was an inside job. Okay, so what does that mean? And then they think out the implications of that. That's what people have to be brave in being able to do. So a lot of people have questions about it, but they don't want to think about it, or they want to just ignore it.
Yeah.
I mean, see, the whole of Western society has been intentionally brainwashed by the media and deceived for so many years. I mean, that's why David Rockefeller thanks the press for their discretion and states, you know, this was 20 years ago, you know, that we could never have done the things we've done without the cooperation of the press, because they completely deceive the American public. I mean, Americans think they live in a democracy.
Well, yes and no. I mean,
in a way that's a complete joke.
Yes and no, because there are definitely parts of the media, not the mainstream media, and there's all sorts of published books that question everything, you know, but the problem is that the term political correctness is completely misapplied in Western societies. Political correctness has got nothing to do with the debates about not calling people bad names or, you know, respecting minorities. I mean, as if there's something wrong with that. But the real political correctness is that the government is out to represent your best interests and that they're interested in your freedom and your democracy. I mean, in the United States, in Canada, in Great Britain, there's in the last 40, 50 years, there's really what there's been is an increasing concentration of wealth in fewer and fewer people. That's the bottom line. That's what everything's really all about, is that fewer and fewer people have more and more money and more power. Yeah. And that, they're calling the shots, they're running things, and there's all sorts of degrees of complicity in this. I think a lot of the media stuff is not really intentionally deceiving people. It's that they buy into all sorts of things and they're compromised in a whole variety of ways by the fact that they're owned by people who are part of this, you know? Like, they're representing certain interests, and if you rock the boat too hard, you know, you won't get your stories on the air, you won't get your stories in the paper, or you won't be working. I mean, then there's myriad.
You'll be marginalized.
There's myriad examples. I mean, you know, the whole Jeffrey Wigand saga, the movie The Insider about Jeffrey Wigand, who was the whistleblower on Big Tobacco, you know, I mean, and how CBS 60 Minutes, you know, we're going to air this story. And then all of a sudden it was crushed because Lawrence Tisch, who owned CBS, was going to sell the company, and he didn't want it, the threat of a lawsuit from Big Tobacco hanging over the sale of CBS. It would have cost him hundreds of millions of dollars, so they killed the story.
Yeah.
You know,
okay.
I mean, that's really...
in another ballpark. I mean, you take the truth of 9/11, and that has to be known by the major folk and all the main networks. That has to be.
I don't agree with that at all. I think that's...
Oh, you're kidding. Because you even see their intentional disinformation program. You see, like, the BBC came up with this supposed thing on 9/11 conspiracy theories, which was like a hit piece, but it's so superficial. It just shows me further their complicity in covering up and their disinformation programs. Like, you see that. You see the kind of fraud excuses they have.
Oh, I don't agree with that. I think that's because people don't believe it. I mean, in some cases, it probably is. It probably is intentional deception, but I think it's just like the Kennedy assassination. You'll still get all these learned people who I respect, who say, well, there's nothing there. And I'm thinking, well, a six-year-old child reading the evidence would realize if there's something there. I mean, I find that the most bizarre thing of all time, you know, that anybody could even doubt that there was two people at least shooting at him at Harvey. And, you know, and that's... That happened, you know, that happened for, what, 45 years ago,
I just watched that the other day, the Kevin Costner in the Stone movie is excellent.
Yeah,
very
interesting. But it goes through everything. I mean, it goes through, do you really think that there would be a war in Iraq if there'd ever been a real accounting of what happened in Vietnam? I mean, you have all these kind of phony representations of what happened in Vietnam about the nobility of it and everything, and that it was a tragedy for the United States. It wasn't that tragedy for the United States. Well, it was a tragedy for the United States.
Yeah, it was, too, for the people.
Yeah, it was a tragedy for the people who had to go and fight and die there for a big lie. But, I mean, it's like Neil Sheehan's book. It was a bright, shining lie. It was just one lie after another. And the worst part of it all, and this is where... You know, you really should read a little history and try to think about it. The worst part of it all is you had, right from the beginning, if you read Daniel Ellsberg's book, Secrets, that he was in the Defense Department, he was in the RAND Corporation as a consultant. He had been to Vietnam very early on, and as he relates, basically the military knew very early on, this thing is not winnable. and yet they continued to lie and misrepresent it, and nobody would take responsibility, and nobody would try to stop it. And so all these people had to go over there and kill and be killed for what? You know, for something that they knew they could never win. And the reason they could never win is because they were on the wrong side, you know? I mean, they weren't over there fighting for democracy. They were over there fighting to prop up a bunch of criminals who, you know, who represented their interests. And basically, when you have Petraeus coming to Washington, it's exactly like Westmoreland, you know? Oh, the tide is turning. There's light at the end of the tunnel. What a complete crock. You know, like the light at the end of the tunnel is a train.
Westmoreland report back to the Americans about the state
of
the Vietnam?
Sure, he lied. He lied through his teeth about body counts and about how things were going well. And I mean, they weren't going well at all.
Yeah.
And they'd see in that case, it was a bunch of journalists, young journalists who went over there, like David Halberstam and Malcolm Brown and Morley Safer, who went over there, and they all went over there thinking that it was a good thing for the Americans to be in Vietnam, and then realizing that the military was consistently misrepresenting the situation, and then the politicians were misrepresenting the situation back home, and it was a complete set of lies. And I mean, even as early as when Kennedy was president, Kennedy said to the publisher of the New York Times, "Who the hell is David Halberstam?" You know, because he was this young reporter, and he was on to them right from the beginning. And he went over there thinking, "Oh, we should be over here fighting communism." But he soon found out, "Well, wait a minute, this is completely misrepresenting the situation here. That this is a lie. This is a serious lie."
So Kennedy was going to stop the war. Like,
well, maybe. Yeah,
that's what I understood too.
Well, more and more scholars who say that you know, as material becomes declassified, is that, I mean, that's one of the points that Stone makes in the movie, and people criticize that, but I've read a fair amount about it, and I think that there's some substance to that he said himself, ultimately it's their fight, you know, and that he was definitely considering, you know, withdrawing from Vietnam, and you know, that would have changed the whole course of the war. But the big point is
and his warnings of the military-industrial complex
that was
and the
Eisenhower.
Shadow government. And
that was Eisenhower, who was...
Kennedy, too. I've been,
well, it was Eisenhower, though, who said it at the end of his presidency. I mean, Eisenhower said, you know, and then Kennedy was going to just, you know, smash the CIA because of the Bay of Pigs. He felt that they had misrepresented things. But all of these things, you know, if these things were even brought up in the context of going to war in Iraq, and people really seriously looked at the history of these things, and if this was represented in the media, instead you get these simplistic, you know, repetitive descriptions of Saddam Hussein as a Middle East madman. Like, compared to who, you know? I mean, you have this bogeyman created, and realistically, is there anybody who really thinks that Iraq is better off now than it was under Saddam Hussein, even though he was a murderous, bloodthirsty, creepy dictator? I mean, that's the problem. I mean, you know, and...
No, it's terrible what has been done. It's been war atrocities, you know?
Well,
I mean, it is. It's over a million people dead, and 4 million refugees, and a land polluted with depleted uranium, and kids with their arms torn off, and no one has electrical power or the water to drink. You know,
it's a humanitarian disaster.
You know,
and getting back to your point is, like, where are the churches through all this?
I know.
Where's the moral outrage and the Christian compassion? I mean, where are they? I mean,
I mean, that's what it's like in the Revelations. It's completely false church arises. And I see that now. It's completely false church.
I mean, I think there are certainly in pockets in every major religion where they have, you know, progressive and people who are committed to social activism. But I mean, you know, they're marginalized generally in churches and generally get themselves in big trouble. I mean, you know, when the Pope John Paul II died, you know, and there was all this, you know, all these accolades about what a great man he was, and I'm thinking, well, you know, sorry, I don't really agree with that. I see him as having been a very regressive and conservative and not at all a person who really furthered brotherhood or humanity.
I mean, I
quest
think there's a whole dark side to that church that was just not understood, and I don't understand it myself, you know. But, you know, there's a lot more we really don't understand about, like, who is behind all the causes of all these things that happen. Like, who controls these groups, who the shadow government and the elites. And, you know, more and more it's like it's discussed on internet radio, you know, and you see it on YouTube and different videos. Like, people are putting it together. People are beginning to wake up a little bit and say, wow, those conspiracy theories are supported by all the facts of all the evidences. Like, it strikes me sometimes how they say, oh, it's conspiracy theory. And I think to myself, well, excuse me, you have quantum theory in physics. Now, it's called quantum theory, but quantum theory is supported by all the facts of physical observation from all laboratory experimentation. So although it's called quantum theory, that doesn't mean that it's just theory. It's a model of of quantum processes, and it's supported by all the data. And the same thing with conspiracy theories. They are conspiracy theories. That's right. They're theories about who these groups are who conspire behind the scenes and do these things and control the government and maintain all these lies and brainwash the public and deceive the human race while they murder people to make money. You know? And there's theories and ideas. People have put a lot of this together, and that's coming more and more available in human consciousness. But it's so far beyond most people's comprehension. It's like people are in a delusional state.
Well, they are.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
They intentionally fostered this kind of delusional state about what's being done, and the whole thing's a complete lie.
Well, but that's, you know, the point is that realistically it's because in our normal waking consciousness is a state of waking sleep, as Gurdjieff says. And you know, I mean, I would say that, I think there are conspiracies. I think there are people who are pulling the strings. I think that, as I say, you know, what's the line from Dylan? You know, money doesn't talk, it swears. I mean, there are financial and political elites who manipulate things. But everything happens, too. That's the other side of it. So, you know, like you say, there's a new consciousness and awareness of this, but I'd say, like, at the end of the 60s, there was a consciousness and awareness of all this about the military-industrial complex and about, everything was out there. And then, you know, things kind of died down and everybody sort of went off did their thing, and it's like, you know, there wasn't that shock to take things further, you know, and people sunk back into their... You know, well, all the young people who were involved in the so-called movement, you know, started getting on with their lives and got into the, you know, their consuming and, the, you know, having children and, you know.
How the American people, in a way, let them get away with not investigating the Kennedy assassination.
Well,
it's so funny because... You see, at the time, not only do you have all the evidences of the actual event being staged and done in an alternate way, but then you always have all the evidences of all the cover-up, because all the cover-up is just evidences of more people's complicity in it.
Do you see it?
I mean, why do they withhold all the evidences and you hear all the different stories from different witnesses and they're murdered all these things happen to witnesses. Like, it's just all further evidences of the whole thing, and people don't grasp that.
Well, I mean, I would say the same thing today about what has happened in
9/11.
In terms of just going to war in Iraq, you know, both times is that realistically, you know, what's even worse now is that after all the lies have been exposed about why Bush went to war in Iraq, is that you have people still saying, well, you know, there was faulty intelligence. I mean, that's another complete crock. That's just a set of lies. It wasn't faulty intelligence. I mean, these guys planned this. They wanted to go to war. They got their war. And what provided them with the excuse was 9/11. And, I mean, until you start to grasp that issue, like the reality of that, you're just deluding yourselves. I mean, I heard, you know... Bill Moyers, journalist who has a program on PBS,
he's
been doing a series of special programs on PBS lately, and he's looking at stories that aren't covered so much. And I think his first program in this series, they were talking about, he was talking about the press and the whole lead up to the Iraq War, and he focused in part on these two guys from the Knight Ritter service who had several articles published where they were kind of questioning the whole, you know, weapons of mass destruction story, and they just didn't see the evidence. And the more experts they talked to, you know, and this stuff got circulated and it was out there, but the stories didn't run in the New York Times or the Washington Post or the LA Times or the Chicago Tribune, any of the bigger papers. These stories were out there. And then at one point he's interviewing Bob Schieffer, who's on 60 Minutes. And he was stationed he was reporting from Jerusalem at the time. And so he comes on and he says, this is his take on what happened. He said, well, you know, in terms of the link between Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda, you know, between Osama bin Laden and Saddam Hussein, you know, in the Middle East, we knew that this was preposterous because, you know, at one point I think bin Laden called Saddam Hussein a socialist infidel or something like that, you know. But I mean, they certainly weren't on the same page at all in terms of their terms of, you know, like, I mean, one's a fundamentalist Muslim and the other one wasn't. One's a Shiite, one's a Sunni. But
yeah.
But anyway, but Schieffer's point was, you know, we knew that, but he said inside Washington, you know, this kind of idea didn't seem to penetrate. And I'm thinking, well, that is without a doubt the biggest, you know, that is so nonsensical, you know. And Moyers is kind of nodding his head and saying, yes, yes. And I'm thinking, no. I live in Toronto, you know. I'm not an expert on the Middle East, but I knew that. I've been saying that, you know, from day one, is that Saddam Hussein, this alleged connection between Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda was so idiotic, so preposterous, that anybody with a brain in their head who looked at it for 2 minutes could realize that this just wasn't the case. And yet, you know, this lie was told over and over again to legitimize starting a war.
Yeah.
You know, like, I mean...
Yeah. And the whole thing, even all the war plans are even in their project for a new American century.
Oh, yeah.
This global super military superpower and kind of like be tyrants over, you know, the world, you know.
Well, there's a quote in from one of those guys involved in the project for a new American century, which is so horrific, but it's so great because it essentially tells you what these guys are. He says, you know, every once in a while, you got to take some crappy little country and throw it up against the wall and beat the snot out of it, basically, to show the world who's boss. And, you know, I'm thinking, well, on the one hand, that's an appalling statement, but on the other, that's an honest statement, because that's the way these guys think, you know. They say, well, go and kick the crap out of somebody, but guess what? Just like in Vietnam, you know, they bit off more than they chewed when they went to Iraq, you know, and now Iraq is a haven for terrorists. That's the ultimate irony, eh? It's like, now they are there.
Well, I mean, the poor people there, you wonder, do they have a right to defend themselves at all without being called a terrorist? Like, it's hard to know if I had tens of thousands of soldiers invading this country and they have arms everywhere and people get murdered every day, it's hard to think that I would be a terrorist if I fought back.
I like the
logic. To know, you know.
I love the logic of this too. Is that now all these people who like to see Americans flex their military might are now saying, well, you know, you've got these guys coming in from Iran who are fighting there, and that this is a provocation for us to attack Iran. And I'm thinking, wait a minute, you guys went halfway around the world to attack a country on some ridiculous pretext, and you're complaining about somebody who lives next door to them, you know, coming in and getting in the fight. I mean, you know, talk about idiotic.
The whole thing is just absolute madness. It was funny. You mentioned Bill Moyer, and I happened to watch a videotape of his from the 1984, and it was about the Iran-Contra affair.
Oh, yeah.
Some of the history of that, and it was shocking because he kind of comes to this whole analysis of the secret government, and I was shocked by it. And people knew that this all back then, kind of. And he goes into Well, the deposing of the when Iran had an elected government figure who was really popular, and I mean it was democratic, and they came in and
it was Mossadegh.
They submerged that government by funding all these terrorists within the country and overthrew, and then put the Shah in, and then the Shah was a tyrant. He tortured 100,000 people, and then he started a war. He started a war with Iraq, and did you know the Americans sold $20 billion of weapons to Iran? So some of Iran's weapons, again, it's like, oh, it's the Americans sold Iran the weapons. And now they got to fight Iran, who has weapons.
It's actually a lot worse than that because they actually, the Americans, the British, the French, and the Germans all supplied weapons to Saddam Hussein to fight Iran, and the Americans provided satellite photos to Iran's defensive positions. But getting back to that happened in 1954. That was Mossadegh, and what he wanted to do, he had this really peculiar idea that the oil in Iran actually belonged to the Iranians.
And, oh, you're kidding.
Yeah. And as the old joke goes, so it's like, where the hell does this guy get the idea that our oil under his sand is his? You know, like, so British Petroleum, who was involved in taking Iranian oil and selling it, and the Americans, and I'm not sure which oil company, it was probably Standard Oil, but it doesn't matter, they're all criminals. They got together, and the CIA, under the direction of Kermit Roosevelt, who was their point man there, he was FDR's son, I believe, or he's one of the Roosevelts, I think he's FDR's son. Anyway, they overthrew him. And the CIA did a profile of the Shah of Iran, who they're going to put on the throne, and they said, well, there's only one problem. He's a complete and utter psychotic. we might really have a problem if we put this guy on the throne. But they did anyway. And, you know, before the whole thing, before the Iranian hostage crisis and everything turned, you know, everybody against the Iranians, really, you know, if you want to talk about a Mideastern madman, the Shah of Iran and the SABAK, which is the secret police in Iran, they were known as probably the worst violators of human rights in the world. I mean, these guys made the East Germans look, you know, like a bunch of choir boys. I mean, that's how bad their reputation was. So, you know, and they were the Americans' friends right up until the day that the hostages were taken, the Iranians, and then they became the enemy. And then because they became the enemy, Saddam Hussein became the Americans' friend, and the West's friend. And then he became the enemy when he decided to go into Kuwait to try to control oil in Kuwait. So, realistically, if you really want the bottom line about all this, it's really essentially about oil. Oh, and by the way, the American government was quite happy with the Taliban being in power in Afghanistan until they said, well, we're not really sure we want to let you build a pipeline to Central Asia to export oil and gas. That's when the problem happened.
That's
well known. I mean,
in
Fahrenheit 9/11, there's a scene where you see these Taliban guys in Washington, because UNICAL is the organization that's building wants to build a pipeline. The biggest deposits of gas and oil in the world are in Central Asia, and to export it, you have to go through Afghanistan. That's the only realistic way to build a pipeline, and that's what there was two consortiums. There was one from Argentina, and there was UNICAL from the States, and they wanted to build these pipelines. And as long as the Taliban was on board with it, nobody really cared that they're a bunch of creeps. It's only when they decided, hey, you know, we're not sure about you building the pipeline, that's when they had to go.
Yeah.
And I mean,
when the fellow in Iran wanted to nationalize the oil field.
Yeah.
Or that's also like what happened in I guess Honduras.
Yep.
Well, because the president there, who was an elected president, returned the land, which was all owned by 5% of the elites, he returned it to the people of the country, and he took it away from World Grocers or some big grocery fruit company. I forget
United
who
fruit
it was
and,
even.
Yeah.
And so then the CIA funded all these groups to ferment problems in the country, and they took over and tortured people again, the whole thing. And they ended up, they returned the land to the elites again.
Well,
you know? It's
again,
just amazing. You just see human history is just the same pattern over and over again.
Yeah, and I'm not really singling out the United States for this, but you know, on a certain level, they're the dominant power in since the Second World War in the world.
Yeah.
And you know, they didn't get that way by being nice to people. You know, I mean, other countries certainly have done this. Colonial powers have done this everywhere in the world. But it's like, you know, when you get down to the rationale about starting a war, well, if you're going to say that because a bunch of terrorists attacked you, that legitimizes you going to war against them, that would actually mean that if all the countries in Central and South America decide to get together and attack the United States, they'd be quite justified by that logic, because the United States has sponsored terrorism in Central and South America for the last 50 years.
Yeah, all around the world they've sponsored terrorism.
Well, but especially in Central and South America. I mean, you know, the death squads in Nicaragua, El Salvador, Guatemala, this isn't like an isolated case. So,
no,
I mean, you can't on any realistic basis, if you're going to look at this with any kind of an open mind, you know, you have to say that realistically, you know, forget all that nonsense that people say about freedom and democracy. It's got nothing to do with freedom and democracy. It's got everything to do with about money and power.
Yeah.
And greed.
Money, sex, and power.
Yeah.
And greed. Yeah. It's horrible. It's amazing. I'm almost 60, approaching 60, and I never really grasped the enormity of it until just over the past year. Just see the kind of psychopathology of the human race and what happened, like how the human race, well, got turned into a rat race, you know, controlled by a pseudo-master race, like I say on my website. You know, there's been these elites kind of scheming all these things in such a way. Because I don't even see, it's not America, it's not the United States who have done all these awful things. It's those who have deceived, it's those within the country.
Yeah.
You know, the criminal element who have usurped power and assassinated Kennedy and have their shadow government and all their black ops groups. These are the terrorists.
They do it in the name of the American people, and that's the shame of it, you know. Because
use their media to convince people, because then the Americans think that they're being noble, they're spreading freedom, you know, like they spread freedom in Vietnam and murdered 2 million
the
country, you know. That's spreading, or is that where that democracy they were spreading, you know?
Again,
and then they put in puppet governments, and they can't even go out of their own quarters because everybody hates them so much, you know? It's so ridiculous,
yeah,
you know?
Well,
they just need to, it's Ron Paul. Ron Paul, I just, you know, he is such a bright light on the American scene. He's just so sensible. He says, America's not meant to be interventionist like this. You know, we don't need to police the world. Why make the American public police the world to have this huge terrorist organization, you know? You know, that's not the American way. That's not what America was ever about, you know?
Well, I have a solution to all this, actually, you know. I think they should pass an international convention, and everybody should have to obey to it, all the countries in the world, that all wars in the future will be fought by white rich guys over 40, and there would be an outbreak of peace like you'd never seen in your life. I mean, that's what I think is most disturbing about all this is, to me, is that the people end up going and fighting, you know, with a real sense of purpose and honor and you know, who serve their country. They think they're serving their country, you know, are always, they never come from these elites, you know. It's like, I mean, people get mad at Michael Moore, but, you know, for his films and for his stunts and things, but I liked it when in Fahrenheit 9/11 when he said, you know, trying to get Congress people to sign their kids up to go over to Iraq, you know.
Yeah. And, well, I mean, sometimes you do see them too, and
by who?
Know, I mean, you even have, you know, different congressmen and senators and who have, you know, served in service and such.
Well, yeah, but in the second,
but I don't think, but even then they realize the devious patterns of what lay under
Yeah, well, I mean, few and far between, really. You know, I mean, Bush and Cheney are more the prime examples. You know, Cheney, I had other priorities in the 60s. That was his comment. You got four draft deferments. You know, I still think that, you know, the Americans should have stayed in Vietnam. And Bush, you evaded service and jumped the line to get in the National Guard in Texas. You know, like, I mean, there in the American Congress, I think when Fahrenheit 9/11 was made, I think there was one or maybe two members of both houses who had any direct member of their family serving.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, they just don't. And the people who go are people who need to go into the forces because it's, you know, because it's economically it's good for them because it gives them a job, you know. I mean, in large part.
And then it amazes me, you know, you got all these intelligence services and police services, and yet none of them, they're all so corrupted, none of them do what they're supposed to be doing, which is arresting people who commit crimes. Like they're all complicit in it. Like the people in the CIA, like, they know who did 9/11. You know, and the FBI, like, these people got to know. Like, they're not dimwits. I mean, they likely maybe are, you know.
Yes and no. I mean,
so it's like the RCMP, Royal Canadian Mounted Police. I call them the Royal Canadian Mounted Perverts. That's what I call them, because they've perverted the meaning of justice. The RCMP protects these criminal elites who's staging these terrorist things in our society. That's what they do now. That's the state of our society now. Not hypothetically, that is the state.
Well,
that is their role.
It depends on who you mean, though. Like I said, you know, like if you look at 9/11, if you read Fariz Ahmed's book, not sure which one it's in, but he's got three books on 9/11 and the Behind the War on Freedom or Behind the War on Terror, whatever, one of those books. He goes through it in great detail, is that there were about four or five different FBI agents. Everybody knows about the one in Minneapolis, I think, but who warned FBI headquarters about suspicious activity by people at flight schools, you know, who were flying planes and practicing taking off but not practicing landing, you know. And there were all sorts, there was all, you know.
I think that whole thing was just done as a cover-up to kind of create confusion and try to create kind of, like, stories.
What do you mean?
Because I don't.
What?
Well, none of those people were on those planes. That's not what happened.
Well, no. But the point is, well, I know. I don't know that, and you don't know that either. Like, I mean.
Well, I mean.
No, you don't. I mean, you don't, because like you know that there's certainly a lot of confusion about that, but as to whether or not, you know. But I mean, nobody really knows what happened there. Like, I mean, I've never read anybody that. But the point is, the point I'm trying to get is that you still have people in the media, mainstream media, talking about failed intelligence, and like what Ahmed and what other critics, David Ray Griffin and I'm trying to think of the Canadian guy's name, have all pointed out, is that there were repeated intelligence sources from within the FBI itself that were somehow at the higher levels of the FBI, you know, were stopped.
Yeah. Like, yeah, not all the people in these services are crooked. No,
I would say most of them aren't. I think they're like, that's why I say, like, you know, I mean, you have to be careful about just saying, like, you know, oh, they're all a group of perverts. Well, I mean, yes and no. I mean, I think that these services are manipulated and used by people in power. There's no question of that. But you know, I think there are all sorts of people who in those services who are doing an honest job and trying to, you know, in that case, I mean, they're trying to bring people to justice, but they were thwarted by their own hierarchy, which is, like, even more frightening in a
sense.
Well,
yeah, well, that's the point. I mean, that's what you got to look. The scum rises to the top. I think that's the easiest way of expressing it.
Yeah.
The scum rises to the top. And I mean, this group of psychopaths have kind of intertwined and interlaced with so many networks and different, you know, from the government to the corporate world to the educational system and so on and so forth. I mean, it's, you know, there's a whole kind of hierarchy. They say Satan has a hierarchy of servants. And most of them are little kind of, like, they themselves are deceived. And they become fodder for who's going to feed on them, you know. But I mean, I was so naive, you know, just a year or so ago to kind of still believe kind of that there was a basic democracy and the basic integrity among our elected officials. Now I see that they're all a group of criminals, criminal conspirators, you know. That's what they've all deceived the Canadian public, just like the American government's deceived, allowed the American people to be intentionally deceived by the media. They've allowed that to happen, allowed that to be done, you know. So, I mean, it's weird to realize that we, in a way, are already in the totalitarian environment. We just kind of didn't realize it because we've been deceived so much. And in a way, their state is already all in place, you know?
Yeah, I guess, I'm much, much less shocked by this because I've kind of seen it for the last 40 or 50 years. And actually, the more I read, the more I realize, oh, it's been this way all along. It's getting worse all the time in the sense that, like you say, I would say since the Second World War, as like Gore Vidal says, that the United States became, with the creation in 1947 of the CIA, became the national security state, you know. And he also says, you know, he refers to it as the United States of Amnesia. And I think that's what to me, that's
people
the main...
People forget the history.
Well, that's the main thing.
We don't learn
and that's,
from history.
That's why, like, you know, I give no credence at all to the most of the stuff that occurs in the mainstream media because it's all put in a context, which is amnesia. It's like where nothing happened 15 minutes ago. Like I say, I'm old enough. I'm 57 years old. I've been through all this with Vietnam. This is like exactly like I say. When I see Petraeus, you know, the only thing that I saw in Petraeus that was even remotely representative of the situation was on the Jon Stewart show where they had this series of clips of him and basically all these different, you know, political guys talking about him as if like he was the second coming of Christ. Like literally, he's a great man. He's this, you know, and they had about 10 of these things, you know, in rapid succession. And then they had Petraeus saying, well, I'm not here to deliver a message that's dictated by the White House. And then they cut to Bush saying something, and then they cut to Petraeus saying exactly the same thing.
Yeah.
Then they cut back to Bush saying something. They cut to Petraeus, and I'm thinking, it's all this theater, you know? It's like,
yeah, yeah,
I mean,
it is.
Petraeus is coming over here, and MoveOn.org put an ad in the New York Times,
yeah.
General Petraeus, exactly, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, there's this other thing that has happened in the media, and this is something that more that bothers me like intensely is that you know, we on the one hand, like, you know, we have this we have to kind of respect the commitment of people in the military, and you know, people always say, well, no matter what you think, you know, you have to support the troops, blah blah blah. Okay, yeah. But you also have to realize, like, I mean, I come from a military family. My father fought in the Second World War. My older brother was colonel in the Canadian Armed Forces, you know. I have respect for the military. But the other side of it is, too, is that, you know, these people are going over and they're committing acts in the name of your government, you know, whether it's the Canadian Army in Afghanistan or whether it's the American Army in Iraq, you know, and there's... You have to question the leadership of the military because these guys, you know, aren't. You have to separate the fact of service from the fact that these guys may not know what they're doing. You know, in fact, you know, or they may be doing things that certain politicians want them to do, which are completely wrong. I mean, that's where I put Petraeus.
Yeah, they're put in terrible positions.
Yeah,
I mean,
what's he going to do?
If you respect your soldiers, you don't put them in positions where they're involved in what's happening in
precisely.
This type of situation from the very beginning. I mean, respect your services, bring them home, and don't have them over there in this illegal, inhumane war.
Yeah, that's what I say. Like, you know, I was like, I mean, it's the same thing. I was like, I wanted the Americans out of Vietnam. I want those guys to come home and not get killed there, and I want them not to kill people. And you know, same thing with the people in Iraq. You know, in Marilyn Young's book, The Vietnam Wars. She has a statistic which I actually wrote to her and asked her to, you know, where she got this from, and I never got a reply from her. But she says that, you know, there were, I think, approximately 53,000 American service people killed in Vietnam. She says that 50, more than that, killed themselves after the war.
Yeah.
You know, and this is the other side of it all. It's like, you know, this is this glorification of the military, but the other side of it all is that, you know what? People who are in wars generally don't come home with a very good feeling about it. You know, there was an article in the New Yorker a couple of years ago talking about the psychological effects of having killed a human being, even when you're in uniform and you're in a military situation where, you know, you're allowed to do it, where you have to do it for your own survival and the survival of your people, taking another human being's life. And I mean, you know, like, I don't know what your experience was, but growing up, like, trying to talk to my father and you know, my friend's fathers about the Second World War, the so-called good war, most of them didn't want to talk about it. Like, it wasn't a very good experience, you know. I mean, they were proud of what they did, but, you know, they'd seen some awful things, and that's, you know, that's the reality of war, and that's the whole other side of it that never gets portrayed in the military, is, you know.
No.
You know,
yeah.
And this is what really irks me about, oh, we can't show coffins coming home. Why not? Why aren't you over at Walter Reed Hospital every day showing people with their limbs blown off, you know? Like, if you really want to honor the people who serve in the military, why don't you go out and tell these people stories, you know? Why don't you talk about how Bush cut back on their benefits, you know, and, like, what the hell that people go through.
Yeah,
like,
or how many people end up like soldiers who they're in weaponry with depleted uranium weapons, and they come back and they got all kinds of cancerous conditions and health conditions, and then the government has this big thing where they deny it for years and years and years, like the Gulf War syndrome, you know,
like Agent Orange
in Vietnam, and then as though they care for the soldiers.
Yeah, and the
you
latest...
You know, the soldiers, it's like they're playing a game of Risk on the board, and the soldiers are these little pawns that they move around. I mean, really, they don't care for the soldiers.
Yeah.
You know, the soldiers care more for the country than their leaders do.
Yeah, and now they kick them out all the time to avoid giving them benefits by saying that they're not mentally fit. You know, that's the latest scam, apparently, that's going on.
Just another scam, one scam after another.
These guys who profess to love these people and honor them and everything, but, you know, they'll honor them just as long as they're over there doing the dirty work, but they don't want to take care of them after they come home. They don't want to take care of their families, you know. Like I say, you know, if you really love them, if you really want to honor them, don't send them to fight stupid wars that don't need to be fought, you know?
Yeah.
Like, you know, when you get attacked, mobilize them. But otherwise, you know, it's like, it's everything's upside down, you know, but it all goes back to kind of the great hypnosis, the great sleep that rules everything, and how, you know, the world is, like Uspensky said about 100 years ago, you know, that the world... Gibbon said history is the history of crime, and, you know, Uspensky says the history of criminal organizations, you know, involved in criminal activities, and it's like that incredible passage in Search of the Miraculous where he said that he came to a meeting with Gurdjieff and the people that they were studying with Gurdjieff in St. Petersburg, Uspensky had been on the street, and he had seen that it was just I guess it was during the First World War. Yeah, because it's before the Revolution, but Russia was in the war by this point. And he said he saw these truckloads, lorry loads of crutches going by, like these trucks filled with crutches. And he said in that moment he had this realization of kind of the hypocrisy of all the fine words and lies which people hide behind, because in these crutches for limbs, which, as he said, were not yet torn off, he kind of saw the duplicity of it all, like the lies of it all, you know, how cynical. It's like, we'll just make more crutches and send them out for all these guys who are going to lose their legs, you know. And he said, you know, and then he thought about everybody who was in the war, you know, and he thought about Berlin, and he thought about London, and he thought about Paris, and he thought about Prague, and all these different cities, you know, that he said he loved so much because each one was so different, had this character, and yet, you know, due to all these lies and due to this sleep, they were at one another's throats and trying to end, you know, one another's existences. And it was, you know, it's an amazing passage.
Each conditioned by their own media into their kind of slant and interpretation of the falsities of it all.
Yeah.
Like, everybody's right, kind of, you know, what they do. Like,
and that's the other side of it. It's like during the Revolution, when the Revolution broke out in Russia, and Uspensky went to Gurdjieff and said that they had to suspend all work, and Gurdjieff said no, And Yuzmenski said, but nothing can be done under these circumstances, and like with revolution, and I mean people running amok, and then, you know, like literally that Russia was in the throes of a civil war and just random criminal activity of all sorts. And Gurdjieff, no, this is the best time because it's like a time of mass psychosis. And in those moments, that's when you really have to work to remember the reality of it all, like to remember yourself, to rise above the tide of irrationality and mass hypnosis and mass psychosis, and yeah, remember yourself, like that this is all not real. To wake up and see it for what it is, you know. I think at times, like that's, I mean, as much as I'm kind of concerned about the world situation, I said, you know, I see all this horror going on around me. In some ways, like I know this is kind of sounds selfish, and but I'd say it's like what Gurdjieff says, is like a conscious egoist. It's like I kind of like, you know, it's going to happen with me or without me, and my position is I want to try to understand it, you know, but I'm in it, but I'm not of it, you know, like as the Sufis say, like that's the way I sort of see myself, you know. It's like at the same time I'm on the radio talking about
here we are kind of like addressing it as issues and such, yeah. You know, I mean, at times I feel enraged by it. I look on the TV and seeing all the liars on TV, you know,
yeah.
I could just see, it's like once you begin to see it, you see right through it.
Yeah.
Like it's an amazing experience,
yeah,
kind of waking up and really begin to see, oh, this is the whole propaganda. This is how they shaped American consciousness. You know, now Americans think that, you know, they've got a right to do preemptive, you know, bombings of another country, Iran, and mass murder another million or so people, and they have a right because this country over there might get nuclear weapons. Which the United States has supplied to Pakistan and Israel, and they got them, and they got tons of nuclear weapons, and this little country, big country, Iran, might get them. Like, the whole thing, like, it's so whacked.
Yeah.
It's so whacked. And then the Americans think that, yeah, we have to do that to protect ourselves. And
yeah,
they don't see what the, excuse me,
yeah,
you are the terrorist. Let's get this straight.
Yeah.
You are terrorizing the people of Iran now. If I lived in Iran, I'd feel terrorized by the United States.
Yeah.
But it's not just the states. It's this satanic element that's kind of taken over the countries of the world. I mean, that's how I see it, as a satanic elite. That's,
yeah, I don't think it's taken over. I mean, I just think it's been there. Like I say, you know, read the accounts of like what happened in the Russian Revolution. You know, read the accounts of what happened in Rwanda. You know, the whole world sat there, and I mean, you know, even Clinton has admitted since then, you know, they could have gone in and stopped that. The United Nations, the United States, everybody knows that they could have gone in and stopped that, you know. Like what happened in Bosnia, you know what I mean? It goes on all the time. It's been going on, like, if you look at the history of the 20th century, it's one big abattoir, you know. It's like India and Pakistan, you know, were partitioned and 10 million people died. You know,
wow,
because,
really? I didn't know.
Oh, yeah.
Know,
well, I'm not sure, because,
wow,
that was a direct result that, you know, of religious violence, you know,
religious,
but also,
yeah,
but also, you know, British imperialism and you know, their refusal, especially under Churchill, you know, the great Churchill, who saved us from Germany, you know, his refusal to allow these people, you know, independence, you know,
Funny because I see, in a way, I mean, the way I see it in a way is that I hope at some point people of good faith, like real Christians or real Jews or real Muslims, people who, you know, that together we rid ourselves of these people who have led us to believe that the conflict is between religions and so on. It never was. It's really this whole other deviant element that's taken over society.
Yeah, well,
I mean, like, Americans, a lot of people think it's a war against the Muslim world. Well, no, it's not. No, it's not. That's just how you've been brainwashed to think. You know, you're the aggressors. You've invaded other countries. You've committed mass murder. You mass murdered your own citizens as a pretext to do it. You know, like, excuse me, you know. And now, and then they're called extremists when anyone wants to fight back. And now there's all these Al-Qaeda in Iran. There were never Al-Qaeda there before. It's like there's this big boogeyman, Osama bin Laden. He's like Santa Claus.
Yeah,
and now they trot out new pseudo tapes of him because they
former CIA agent.
Maybe still
CIA agent.
That's
the really...
The FBI doesn't even have a warrant out for him because there was no evidence of his involvement in 9/11, you know? There wasn't. He even said himself in the one tape known to be authentic, he said, I really don't know who did it, some special interest in the country, he said.
Well,
that's what I saw. And then they came out, the FBI produced a tape where he admits it, but then that was shown to be a fraud. Well, then don't people kind of put two and two together?
I mean, okay. I'm not sure that that's true.
Well, the tape, have you seen it where he has a gold ring on his right hand and he's right-handed?
No.
And they did analysis of his facial structure and the length of his nose and everything. Well, this has been exposed on.
I know is that you ought to be able to find a 6'7" guy dragging the dialysis machine around behind him, you know, with the most sophisticated military in the world ought to be able to knock that guy down, you know, if they really wanted to get him. I mean, there's reports that, you know, that he was visited by a CIA agent in, I think it was Bahrain. It was the United Arab Emirates. He was in a hospital.
At a hospital.
Yeah.
Before
9/11. That report's gone around for a long time.
Yeah, I've heard that.
And I mean, you know, if you go back to the whole history of what happened in Afghanistan and how, you know, the CIA funded the Islamic fundamentalists, you know, that's the problem, is that, you know, you create these situations.
I hate to interject here, guys.
Yeah.
You know, I love you. You're amazing. I mean, I sit here and listen to programs in the studio day in, day out. I hear them constantly. Yours is spectacular. I tell you that every time I get you off the air, when I listen to your program now, you think like me. I don't know how to put it any other way. You think exactly like I do. And we're in a mind meld here. It seems to be working with people across the planet. It's almost like an energy, a wake-up energy. But I'll tell you, it's beautiful, and I love listening to you. I just had to tell you. I really did.
Wow.
Yeah, thanks.
Thanks a lot. Because I kind of wondered, like, boy, I wonder what Don and Doug think about all this, you know? I mean, the fact that we're still on, I guess they're okay with it.
Well, you guys, I mean, what's amazing is you're telling people exactly what I tell others in the office here. I mean, almost verbatim.
Yeah.
I really got to tell you, folks, if you don't think people are waking up, I mean, I'm living proof that you can wake up.
Yeah, well, I am too. I am too. Far too late. Oh,
exactly.
We're all late in this.
Well, I'm living proof that you can sleep through pretty much anything.
Well, I love you guys. I'm going to headline this. Keep going. I'm going to headline it all over the place, only because you're saying something that is so profound in today's excited energy state, and that is that the veils, what we truly understood in the past is that it's all really an illusion. Even with our governments and every facet of the media and every facet of what they do when it comes to our health and Medicare and how they set up the system and why it was set up this way and why it's really a system of veils. Anyways, I'm not going to get into it here, but I love you guys. It's just, it's beautiful, and I love hearing you.
Well, thanks a lot.
Yeah, well, thanks for coming on and interjecting, and I didn't know if we were going on too much.
Yeah, I didn't either.
We hadn't intended to get into...
No, you're just making clear everybody's thoughts. I love it.
In other words,
you really are. You're putting into words what other people really are just starting to understand, and that's the beauty of it, because you're right on.
Yeah.
Right on.
Oh.
Love you.
Thanks, hey. Don.
Thanks, Don.
Love you guys. Yeah, that's just the profound importance of these type of internet radio shows and YouTube and this is just so important now, Pete. And you know,
I was just going to say the same thing. I mean, this is one way in which I think the internet is such a dramatic democratic weapon. You know, think back to like when the Soviet Union in the 50s and 60s. You know, if the internet had existed then, you know, I mean, I don't think it would ever have lasted even as long as it did. You know, that's the great equalizer I think that we do have in the West, is that we still have some freedom of expression, and the internet is a real alternative. And now, I mean, you know, we're 57, but there's a whole generation coming up that they don't tune into CBS News or read the New York Times, or, you know, like, they're not oriented at all to the mainstream media, and they go on the internet, and they use YouTube, and they use, you know, all these alternative sources, that's the one kind of saving grace, I think, in terms of media, is that this decentralization of the media, decentralization and also internationalization. Like I say, we probably have somebody listening to us in New Zealand or somebody in Bangkok. I don't know.
I hope that's happening enough. I mean, I just pray that there is this synchronous kind of awakening, as Don comes on and says it, like, this is happening now, and now we need this now. We're at such a critical phase. You know, if we were talking about the war in Iran, you know, if we have another, you know, process of reciprocal destruction, as Gurdjieff called it, you know, and mass murder another million people, you know.
Yeah.
Even using nuclear weapons. Like, come on, you guys. You know, just buy oil from them. You know, oh no, it's nuclear weapons. Oh, it's so insane, the whole thing.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I mean, and it's this constant brainwashing, which is the real political correctness that, you know, if we don't spend all this money on the military and on weaponry, you know, our way of life is threatened, and, you know, the barbarian hordes will overwhelm us. But it's funny, eh? It's like the people who are small-c conservatives who are always the first ones to say, you can't solve any problem, like poverty or health care, by throwing a lot of money at it. What do they want to do? They always want to spend more money on the military budget, and they want to spend money, more money on the war on drugs, which is, you know, the two biggest rip-offs, you know. I mean,
they work both ends of that war, because they bring the drugs in, and then they control the police, and they have sacrifices here and there, and carry on, and they got the huge amount of money they take out of, you know, they use the drug money to fund a lot of their covert covert activities. I mean, it's central to it, you know?
Yeah, well, and, you know, if you read Peter Dale Scott, who is a former Canadian diplomat who's based in the States and has written a series of books, he talks quite extensively. I read in a book about deep politics and the JFK assassination. He talks about how the drug trade has always been a major source of revenue for these alliances of political and criminal organizations. I mean,
they're into it all. They're into the sex slaves and the pedophilia. I mean, there's a whole vast interconnected spider.
You know,
it spreads its tentacles through society and gets its hook on people and saps their soul life out of them.
It's funny, you know. I'm kind of working on some essays in honor of Jonathan Cott, my friend who's a journalist, former contributing editor to Rolling Stone magazine, American writer.
Probably one of the most famous American writers of the century, I would have thought, last century. He had about like 4 or 5, 6, 10 books.
15, I think. 15? 14 or 15.
And he wrote for Rolling Stone. I mean, he was a unique contributor to Rolling Stone, having kind of done interviews with Lennon and
all the major, all the major musical figures,
Miller,
rock and roll, and Henry Miller, and that's what I'm focusing on. But I was kind of thinking back, you know, like over the last 40 years, like Rolling Stone started in 1967, 68, I think, in Berkeley, and Jonathan Cott was a friend of Jan Wenner's who created the magazine. And one of the things I was going to do was to focus on figures that Jonathan Cott had interviewed and whom we both share an interest in. And, of course, one was Henry Miller, who he did a great interview with, and another was John Lennon. He did one of the last major interviews, if not the last major interview, before he was assassinated. And Dylan, and you know, I was thinking in terms of kind of cultural memory and cultural insight. Like, you can go right back to, like, Dylan wrote Masters of War in, what, 1963, I think? And
oh, yeah, was it?
And, you know, what you said, you could see through things. If there's a line at the end of that song where he says, you know, I see through your mask, and I see through you like the water that runs down my drain, you know, and I'm thinking, yeah, it's like, you know, the artists are always the ones. Don't look to the mainstream, you know, your newspapers and your magazines and your television and radio. Look to the artists, because the artists see through these things. Henry Miller wrote, you know, Henry Miller's an interesting writer. He's my favorite writer in the sense that not so much he's famous and infamous for being a sexual writer, but that's not kind of what I like about his writing. He wrote a lot of different types of work, and most of it was autobiographical, but he wrote a lot of really brilliant essays, and he wrote an anti-war essay, which he began at the beginning of the Second World War, and which he completed after the Second World War. It's in two parts, and it's called Murder the Murderer. And Miller was an anarchist. He grew up politically, Emma Goldman was a famous American anarchist, or a Russian anarchist who lived in the States, and he was very influenced by her in the teens and the 20s, and he knew John Reed, who became the famous for reporting on the Russian Revolution. He was part of that whole circle, but he wasn't a political guy. He really stood outside of the political situation. And he analyzes the Second World War. He starts writing about his friend had volunteered to serve in the French army. And Miller had no interest in who won the war, in the whole thing. He was outside of it all. And he wrote this brilliant essay, which is an anti-war essay, and he breaks things down, and his essential point is basically this, that it doesn't matter what the state is, if it's the American state, or if it's the British state, if it's the French or the German or the Italian. The state wants you to go out and serve them by putting your life on the line to guarantee some sort of promise of a future life which is going to be better than the one you have now, or which is going to preserve what's valuable about the way of life now. So you start reading this essay, and it's kind of like, at one point he says, in this sense, I can see no difference between Mussolini and Hitler and, you know, the good guys, Roosevelt, Churchill, and Stalin. Of course, Stalin was on our side in those days. And he says, they all want you to do the same thing. They want you to go out and die for them. And he says, this is all a fraud. This is a promise that the state has no intention of keeping and can't keep. And you know, it's ridiculous. Now, what's interesting about this, I read this essay in the early 80s, and it applied so perfectly. He does a whole analysis of armaments and munitions and the kind of military madness, and he says, you know, that it's all a fraud, and that they're always protecting you against the next great threat. So I read this in the early 80s, and along comes Ronald Reagan and says we have to spend more money on defense and we have to arm the heavens, and Miller predicted that in 1945. He says, you know, you think the atomic bomb is going to be the end of it? You know, that's just the first little present from these characters. And pretty soon they'll be arming the stars themselves, you know. And what's really interesting about it is that he's analyzing things in categories that are completely outside of the mainstream of socio-political economic analysis. He's analyzing them psychologically.
Yeah.
And it applied in 1980, in 1984, to Ronald Reagan and to Mikhail Gorbachev and the Russian-American thing. And then the Soviet Empire ends, and all of a sudden, guess what? We have terrorism. Now
yeah,
it's terrorism.
Yeah. The big boogeyman
that's now going to end our lives. And you know that if we don't go out and kill people, well, you know, it's one step from hell.
But it's funny because at the same time, they are actually creating terrorism within the country itself. Through their forces. Because they're now building all these kind of unoccupied at the moment camps in the states, like 600 of them, and they're militarizing these kind of quasi police military units and all these black ones. They're creating conditions for terror at home within our own society, where they want to have chips in us. Like, holy smokes, some person is so whacked out.
Well,
they're so paranoid.
It even goes back to like, you know, the whole Star Wars thing, which is, you know, that they were going to build this defensive shield. This is, you know, Reagan's big idea, and they're still, you know, working on it. There's only a couple of problems. Number one, it doesn't work. You know, I mean, it just doesn't work. Technologically, it's so far beyond where people are in terms of military development. But the more important point, like I remember seeing Carl Sagan was on one of the morning television programs, and George Will, the conservative newspaper columnist, was on, and they were discussing Star Wars. This would be like 1981, 1982, you know, around that period, maybe a little bit later. And Sagan said, well, you know, the only problem is that somebody could take a suitcase into Grand Central Station, or, you know, could take a suitcase into the Capitol building in Washington with a nuclear bomb in it. You know, I mean, who says that somebody's going to attack you from outside is going to launch missiles?
Yeah,
you know?
Or be done by people within our country.
Well,
I mean, I'm far more afraid of terrorist activities done by the elites within our own country. I'm far more fearful of that than I am of any real, like, Muslim terrorist coming over here and doing something.
Yeah, well,
or this elite doing these things, which they then got some patsy who they've kind of done something to, and they commit some fraud thing, and then they put him in jail, and no one can hear about anything of the trial because of national security, so they cover up their crimes, you know? But I'm far more... I feel more terrorized by our own governments than I do by any person over in Iran who might get a nuclear bomb.
Yeah, well,
it's still 5,000 miles away.
Those people scare me because I think those people do exist, and I don't think that they're all black ops, and I don't think that they're all patsies, and I don't think they're all false flag operations. But having said that, I agree with you.
I don't know what major thing in modern times hasn't proven to be a false flag operation.
Well, I mean, you know, I think that the first bombing of the World Trade Center, I mean, let's put it this way.
I don't know enough about the history of that.
Then you can't say that. I mean, you know.
No, I don't know.
If you look at these Islamofascists, these people are pretty whacked. I mean, the Islamofascists are real, and they are whacked.
And
they do blow people up. The problem is, again, this is the whole thing, like, you're going to go to war in Iraq. You're going to go to war in Afghanistan. Meanwhile, in Pakistan, you got the guy who's the father of the atomic bomb, who's basically giving out plans to build these to any nut bar that'll pay them, and you don't want to do anything about him. You know, I mean, if you're going to have a war in Afghanistan, how can you make friends with Pakistan and say that they're allies in the war on terror? It's so arbitrary, it's so stupid, you know. Wait a minute. I think I have the solution. They're not going to build a pipeline through Pakistan to get gas. That's what it's about. I mean, it's just so obvious, you know.
But coming back to the point, I think for North Americans, we have more to fear of our own governments and elites within our society than we do from any threat posed to us from people from that part of the world. And if we hadn't terrorized them and invaded their countries and tried to take their oil and so on.
Well, I wouldn't disagree with that at all.
We would just neutralize that world terrorist threat. I mean,
yeah.
the, I mean,
Well, I mean,
you're right. As you say now, I mean, there is terrorism in the world now. I mean, you know, millions of people have been murdered through these different wars and so on.
But if you even break it down to that, like, you know, it's like, I mean, ultimately, you know, you look at all this money, what it goes into and everything, and even if there are people who were going to attack you, you know, you'd be better off just paying them protection money. It's like, here, we'll give you $50 million a year. Leave us alone, you know? Like, I mean, that's somewhat facetious, but it's actually realistic in the sense that, like, you know, the broader point is that if we spend half the resources in the West trying to actually help people in the rest of the world develop themselves and you know, have a higher standard of living and deal with these things, maybe they wouldn't hate us so much, you know, instead of going and stealing their resources and exploiting their labor and, you know, trying to sell them water, you know, like in Bolivia where they, you know, they wanted to privatize the water supply and sell people water. I mean, their own water. I mean, you know, like,
it's kind of like your view of terror. Like, the public's view of terrorism is it's over in the Middle East more. But see, also, we got to see what's happening in our society. For instance, like, I watch chemtrails now. So I see the days that they do these kind of heavy, high atmospheric trails. The planes leave them. They go from one end of the horizon to the other horizon. So they're like 50 miles long, and you see how they come down and form clouds. I'm kind of observing more and more chemtrails, and they do it particular days, and other days are clear, and you can, now, someone in chemtrails, there's evidences that these contain aluminum and barium salts, heavy metals, carcinogenic and viral matter. At times there's been anthrax in them, pharmaceuticals, thanks to the big pharma. Thank you, guys. And so we, in a way, it's like they're in a way from above. They're spraying us as though you had a human being. Imagine spraying ants on the ground.
Who is spraying who? Like, with what? I don't understand that.
Well, this is being consistently done throughout North America and elsewhere in the world, that you get chemtrails.
For what purpose?
Well, they're spraying us. Is this part of their genocidal plans?
No, but
with different purposes. It spreads illness. Spreads illness is a major one. It likely has different sedative and other neurological influences on people.
What's the point of it?
Well, if you were spraying ants on the sidewalk, you would spray them to weaken them so that they're more susceptible.
Okay. I guess I'm kind of skeptical about this. What's the purpose? I mean, people are already...
To commit genocide.
Well, why do they want to kill... You mean, but who's trying to kill us?
The neo-Nazis who are in these elites, these satanic elites.
But they need it. They need us. I mean,
No, they don't. They need a lot fewer of us.
Oh.
See, they want to reduce the world's population from 6 billion to...
I'm doing a very good job of it. The world's population is...
Well,
but like
they have a lot of plans in store for people.
Oh.
They have all different weapons now, but one of them is chemtrail spraying.
Yeah,
you know,
as well as their injections
and the big pharma and these new injections that they're giving for HPV and flu shots and so on. Like, these have ingredients. There's evidences that these contain, again, aluminum and mercury as poisons to the body.
Well, I mean, you know, all those things exist in the atmosphere already. These are
intentional chemical sprayings, Jim. Like, this is well documented.
For what purpose? I mean, the planet's already incredibly poisoned, you know, like, I mean, by industry. Industry already, you know, like, I mean, you don't really have to, I don't get that.
It's a way of committing genocide where people don't realize it. But people
like
get
say,
sick.
What's
like
the
you
what's
spread,
the
say you spread aluminum. The principal ingredient of these historically has been aluminum. Different times they experiment with other things. We'll likely get an avian flu probably at one point. They'll try spreading things like through this method. Okay. Aluminum. They spread aluminum. Well, there's dramatic increases in the number of people with Alzheimer's, and one of the suspected causes of Alzheimer's is aluminum. So maybe that's one of the reasons that they've causing us Alzheimer's. There's huge increases in autism. This is a lot of reaction to some of the pharmaceuticals. There's dramatic drops in fertility among people.
There's an explanation for autism. I mean, it's in the additive that was in the vaccines. That's well documented, but that's got nothing to do with chemtrails. I mean,
I didn't say that with chemtrails. No, I meant to the. Sorry, I did that. I was.
I mean, like,
that
as a pharmaceutical. Well, I mean, let's get even more simple. I mean, I live on Lake Ontario. Well, you know, which is one of the great lakes. It's also one of the great chemical soups in the world, and your chances of your life expectancy goes down 10 years depending on if you live within 100 miles of one of the Great Lakes. You know, I mean, you don't have to spray people with pollution.
Well, whether you do or not doesn't really matter, because they are. That's what the evidence shows. And there's.
But again, who and why? What's the purpose? I don't get it.
Well, I don't understand that fully. I mean, you have to go into who these elites are and what the substances are. And there must be a science to this. Like, they've studied it. You know, like the descent of these clouds and what effects they have. I don't know enough about it. It needs to be, it needs to be criminally investigated by the police services. But no one does anything because no one has any control over these shadow elements who are doing the chemtrails. I mean, try to, you find out who's doing it. You can see them. I can see them. I have videotape of them. You can see them all over the internet.
Well,
these massive chemical sprayings.
Are you sure this isn't just like the fallout from jet planes?
No. If you see a normal plane, it might have like a trail. There's another word for it. It's not a calm trail or something that
the
extends out behind it, because it vaporizes it vaporizes the water and such, and there's some emission. No, these are planes that go from one end of the horizon right across the sky, really high, leaving this huge chemtrail behind them. And it lasts for hours. And you can see them float down, and they form these type of long striated clouds. Calm trails or regular trails. This is something different. This is them chemically spraying people in different areas.
Them and, you know, who's them? I mean, who's
doing it?
Yeah, and why?
Do you want me to give you their names?
No, I just like, it's like, you know, it's easy to say they're doing it, and like I said, I'm just playing devil's advocate here, because it's like there is pretty vague, and for what purpose? That's I guess my more.
It's like the Nazis. They wanted to exterminate different people. It's sometimes called culling. Like, say you got the flock.
Oh, yeah, I get that. But, I mean, like, that's so indiscriminate. There's got to be a more, if you want to get rid of people, like, there's got to be a more specific way. Like, I mean, you know, you could get them through cheese or something, you know?
Through other ways, too. I mean, it's a different approaches that they're taking. I mean, one thing they're doing now is their irradiation of food, so that they're... It causes more carcinogenic processes, and it breaks down the substances in the food, so the food is more and more empty. Okay, so that's another way in which they're trying to weaken human beings.
There's a million different things with these, but I don't see any of those as being like to weaken people. It's all economic, you know. It's like,
no,
it's like,
not though.
It's not
economic to take all this expensive spraying us from in the higher atmospheres and
no,
spraying
I'm
all
saying you're talking about irradiated food. The reason for irradiated food is because it's economical and people can make more money off it. It's the same like with genetic engineering, crop engineering. It's you know, Monsanto can make lots of money from it. That's why they do it. You know, I don't think Monsanto, you know, that's the problem. They don't care what the effects of it. They don't care about the dangers
of it. No, they don't.
But like I say, it's money that motivates this. I don't think it's a conspiracy to weaken people. I don't think they care about that. All they care about is how can we make more money. You know,
well,
like,
I think behind it all is this more systematic attempt to commit genocide. That's what I believe. They want to cull the human race, kill off people in different areas.
Well, they're doing a miserable job of it, because the population's exploding. Like, I mean, you know, like you could kill half the people in the world, and the population of the planet is still just be back at like the levels of what I mean, you know, what it was like the turn of the 20th century. Like it's not doing. They're not doing a very good job of it.
Well, I think they. Yeah, that's why I think they have to do bigger things. But I think that's coming up.
Well, but I mean, frankly, I think that's kind of late. Well, I look into
chemtrails.
No,
you tried to tell me why people would be spraying us with these substances.
Well, I'll play devil's advocate for you here. It's like if you read Laurie Garrett's book, The Coming Plague, nature will take care of this before, much more efficiently than people purposely spraying and trying to weaken people. There's going to be a major plague, which will wipe out a large portion of this planet at some point in the next 100 years, probably.
And it's
for reasons, because there are too many people on the planet.
Was going to release this plague?
Well, no, nature.
No, but that's how I would see it. And yeah, and when the plague comes, what's going to have produced the plague? And I would say is going to be these same people who are going to probably spray it on you from above.
I don't agree with that at all.
Yeah.
I think it's like, you know...
If they want a variant flu, they can spread some avian flu, and then they got the pharmaceutical drugs you can get that give you injections against flu.
You're kind of making something that... You're trying to impute motives to things that have, like, much more benign or less purposeful explanation.
Oh, sinister.
You're kind of missing the point is that, avian flu is an interesting example. Like various diseases that are spread, a combination of things is like, the population of the world is so mobile now, so anything that's communicable can be global in a matter of days or AIDS is an example. But now that's an issue too as to what AIDS was. But because people are encroaching on territories where, where people didn't live before, and because the geography of the planet is changing in terms of the increase in the population and the exploitation of resources, plus the communications and the travel, It means that things are becoming much more intricately and subtly involved, and it's very easy for any kind of disease to spread globally. I mean, that's...
Okay.
I'm
just saying, like, here again, see, you would think that the more likely way is that this disease is going to arise naturally somewhere. And my expectation is that this shadow groups in our government have all kinds of these agents available for us, and that they will stage or release that themselves. So I fear more, like we're going back to what we were talking about before, where I was saying I fear the terrorists in our own society more than I fear the terrorists like over in the
other side of the world. Killing your own people, like genocide.
But it's not that your own people. They don't identify with that.
Well,
they identify with themselves as the elite.
Yeah, but
it's not there. They don't identify with being Americans. Like
my question is, what is the purpose of this? It's nonsensical.
The ascendancy of this neo-Nazi group, Jim. Satanic neo-Nazi group that's been around for a few centuries.
Yeah, but what's the purpose? Like, it makes no sense to me. It's like, okay, we're going to kill these people. We're going to commit genocide against, the population of the United States and Canada? Is that the idea? Why?
Not fully. Some parts.
Well,
yes.
It seems to me like
some
very...
Some people.
Seems to
yeah.
me to be a very sloppy way if you're going to try to wipe people out. Like, I mean, the easier way is just put them in prison.
Well, they have plans for that.
Yeah, well.
Well, that's what I was saying. They're constructing this whole framework of like these massive prisons in the States, which have yet to be filled. Because all of a sudden they're going to find all these terrorists in their own society. They're going to need to put into them.
Well, I mean, actually,
this is the march of the neo-Nazis if they carry their agenda forward. This is the
The facts kind of disagree with that in the sense that under the Terrorist Act in the United States, if you actually look at the people who've been arrested in the United States, there hasn't been one conviction of anybody under the
No, most of them, they just set up themselves. They become involved with people and try to get them going. I mean, most of them are hoaxes. It's like it's TV entertainment. It's Hollywood. And so then they have to have secret trials. And, you know, and it's all dealt with undercover, so you never know. And they can maintain this kind of feeling that there's all these big threats, you know, where someone left a bag somewhere and it's a big threat and it's, you know, and it creates all this fear among people. They are creating the fear in the American psyche intentionally to create this kind of fear of terrorism.
I agree with that, but I think it's a long way from that to saying that, you know, there's going to be mass incarcerations or they say people are committing genocide by spraying stuff out of planes. I mean, I don't buy that. You know,
study chemtrails.
Yeah,
the evidence, go on the internet and read, and they've had fellow on Coast to Coast and other talk shows talking about chemtrails. We're being sprayed by chemtrails. It happens. Put your eyes up high. Look in the sky.
Yeah, but
I can see them. I can see what days are these huge things.
And where do these people live that they're not affected by them?
I don't know exactly, Jim. Ways. I don't know.
I'd say that's a germane question, but again, I don't understand the motivation. As I say, if you want to talk about people being poisoned, hey, I can talk to you for hours about people being poisoned by processes that give us the bounty of wonderful consumer goods that we have. You know, I mean, it's one big poison factory, basically, the industry in the developed world.
Yes, and I see how our views are different. You think it's just due to people's incompetence. And I believe that there's a more systematic, sinister attempt to commit it. And most of the people involved in it don't really grasp what they're doing. They're controlled and blackmailed in different ways.
I agree. I mean, I don't think it's this sinister cabal of people. I think it's mainly people who want to make money.
Very differently because
money,
I see there as being such a secret cabal.
Money and power.
I see it as being much more underground. And it tying into all these dark orders and the skull and bones and the corruption of masonry and a lot of the kind of satanic aspects of these groups, you know, and it's all tied into the sexual aspect is a huge component of it. You know, I mean, the sexual meanderings of, you know, these groups and that are, you know, quite something. I see it as being such a secret cabal of people who have such highly devious motives and such. You know, one example, I'll just give an example illustration of this. I remember seeing a symbol from Nazi Germany, and it was this famous Nazi sculpture, which was this huge black widow spider. And this huge mother black widow spider had like seven pods or seven outgrowths. So there was the mother spider and then these seven. And then it shocked me a few months ago, kind of realizing, or last year, that in Ottawa, in front of the War Museum, is a big giant tarantula, a black widow spider. And it's exactly of the same type as this black widow spider of Nazi Germany. So here's this symbol of Nazi Germany right out in front of the War Museum in Ottawa. Okay? And then I, on the internet, I see, here's another black widow spider at the Rockefeller Center in New York City. Another one of the spiders. And again, it's another huge 30 to 40 foot sculpture. And then there's another one in the World Court in The Hague. Okay, so I believe that. I would just say that. Yeah, look in those elements. People and you know, it's
what's
it's
the point
emerging.
Of that though?
So what I'm saying is there's been this kind of neo-Nazi fascist group, and they've carried on since the Nazism of the Second World War, and they all went in the CIA, and now we have the same people doing similar things in other circumstances.
You know what the Black Widow symbolizes, though? They were where that came from? Because you know, like the swastika, you know where the swastika came from, eh?
The secret doctrine of Blavatsky.
It comes from Tibet. I mean, it's thousands of years old.
I thought Hitler got it from the secret doctrine of Blavatsky.
He might have, but it's a Tibetan symbol. I mean, and it's
yes, it is.
It's
yeah.
apparently like millennia old. Like it's very, very ancient. Eh?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, well, that's the whole kind of argument about.
Yeah, and they flipped it around. In Blavatsky's presentation of it, she has it turning counterclockwise.
Oh, okay.
And the Nazis took it and switched it so it turns clockwise.
Yeah.
One is like creation and the other might represent destruction.
Yeah, of course, you know, I mean, the Nazis also took crosses, too, you know.
That's what's done in satanic groups. They take the religious symbols. Like, you know how our cross is?
Yeah.
I say that I think our cross actually is upside down and that really it should be what we consider upside down, which I think is right. And the early Christians were hung upside down.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. It was only Christ who was supposed to, and the two who were crucified with him who were hung right side up. But I think really the cross is supposed to be upside down, and in early pictures of the papacy, you see sometimes they have the cross upside down, which I think is a more ancient meaning of it.
Hmm.
But, I mean, that has to do with the white and black influences in the church, you know.
Well, here's something to switch gears a little bit. I mean, you're talking about
we have about 5 minutes. So
yeah,
we
you're talking about this like this current of of satanic elements and evil cabals, and I mean the other side of things is that throughout world history, I mean this is getting back to your original point about the esoteric origins of religion. You know, throughout history. There's been this whole esoteric tradition, ongoing current, which has been promoting and trying to develop ways for people to awaken and to know themselves and to know the universe and the gods. And this has run throughout history. And it's basically sort of the hidden history of humanity, and yet it exists and it exerts influences and is very profound, you know. And so like that's the other side of everything, eh? Is that okay? We can focus on all these negative aspects, and we spent 2 hours talking about mostly about these negative aspects. But then there's this whole other side of things, eh? That you know that we've been exploring for 30 years, and we just scratched the surface of in a way. And there's like that whole, you know, where are these people? You know, I mean, they still exist amongst us. But, I mean, there's no reason to believe that there aren't all sorts of esoteric influences operative today in the world. So,
it's funny because I see almost, it's like the people on the side of white magic have not done anything. They've been asleep. And the people on the side of dark magic have
But that's that's kind of presumptuous because... In a way, like, I mean, how would you know?
That's just what I think about in the world.
Yeah, but I'm asking you, how do you know that?
Well, I don't know that.
Yeah, exactly. You don't know that. And that's what I would say is, like, we don't know that. I mean...
Well, I think in a way we don't... I think that we wouldn't be in the situation we're in now if that had been so.
No, but I think that's a really naive and quite misrepresentative interpretation of the history of humankind. I mean, because I think you think that there's something unique about the situation now, and I would say, well, there is unique in terms of because of the absolute, you know, devastating technology for destroying people. That's what's unique about our situation. But I don't see this situation as being unique at all. I think this has been going on for thousands of years, you know. I mean, like, read about the European witch craze. I mean, they basically killed about a third of the population of Europe, you know.
Yeah.
And if you were a woman or if you were Jewish, you were pretty much dead, you know.
But
I would say... So, like, I mean, it's not like, I mean, and even in our own century, you know, like, I mean, Pol Pot killed a couple of million people in Cambodia. You know, Stalin starved 7 or 8 million people in the Ukraine.
Yeah.
Mao starved 10 million people in China, you know. The Japanese murdered 2 million people in Nanking. I mean, you know, I could go on and on. I mean,
what I'm saying is that, yeah, I'm agreeing that I think there's this whole unseen element that has, through history, has been behind these events. And there's a lot of things historically we've not really understood.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think we're in a unique time in a way, I think, because of the 9/11 events, because I think this group, really the evidence, the criminal evidence is there that any sane, intelligent person who examines the evidence around 9/11 has to conclude it was an inside job and has to realize this conspiracy that's occurred within our society. So in a way, I think for the first time they've exposed themselves in a wholly new way. It could have been done with Kennedy, but now Kennedy's resurfaced because all this new evidence has come out about it. So really now you could continue, I think, pick up the Kennedy prosecutions, you know, and get at the same groups at the same time. I mean, the evidence is they're coming out there, like people, you know, you have all these investigators, you know, who are sharing this information about the elites and history and so on. You know,
yeah,
I think,
but again, you know, like, I mean, I guess it's just sort of a matter of perspective, you know. Hitler and his little band, you know, they did their thing, and
I'm not sure they just did their thing.
Well,
they did
their thing, and there was skullduggery on both sides. Perhaps, and 50 million people are dead. What's the count so far as a result of 9/11? Drop in the bucket in terms of human beings.
You're right.
Drop in the bucket. Like, I mean, it's not even Rwanda. You know, I mean, if you take a million dead in Iraq, and I don't know how many hundreds of thousands in Afghanistan, and, you know, 4,000 dead in New York and Washington, I mean, like, in the big picture of things, you know, if you just want to, I mean, it's crass to say this, but I mean, like, in terms of numbers, it's nothing. I mean, like, you know, how many people have died in the Sudan, you know?
I'm not sure what your point is now. But
I'm just saying that, you know, like, you're talking about this as if this is, like, some sort of, special because of its magnitude, or I'm just saying.
Not because of the loss of life, but because of the deception. Because it shows us what we were deceived to believe, what the Hollywood story was versus what was the reality, and because then it implicates the whole math psychoses produced by the media and their intentional deception of the American public.
Well, I guess,
I think we see the whole structure of the whole thing more clearly now.
Well, I guess I'm saying, like, you know, if you look at the history, and even in the United States, of the Second World War, of the Korean War, of the Vietnam War, you know, that these things have been going on. This didn't start, like, overnight.
And no, you're right.
Consistent
you're
pattern
absolutely
of,
right with that.
They may,
no,
have upped, may have upped the ante. I mean, I'll give you that one. You know, 9/11 is, like, off the charts in terms.
No, for me, that was the shock. The other things, I had never read enough about history and politics and such to be aware enough of that. I'd never grasped it before. But now it's like clear, and now I see everything in a different way, and everything you have to kind of reconsider what you thought you knew about everything. You know, from what happened to Kennedy to what happened in different wars to what the wars were about to what's happening in the society about, you know, with the pharmaceutical companies, the control of the government by corporations. I mean, you know, all of these things, it's terrible. I mean, I just hope the peoples of the world can save our world from the destructive courses we're on. So it's like overcoming this mass psychosis, and I think people waking up and getting the right shocks that we kind of put the reins on this madness in modern times. It's like our weaponry is too advanced anymore. We can't just...
Well, they say knowledge is power, so let's hope that, you know, that the more information that's out there to challenge the conventional interpretation and representation of things will turn more people. I mean, I see it as, like, I see, like, you know, like Don was saying, you know, that there's this synchronous movement in some ways, and in the other ways, I'm kind of pessimistic because I see kind of the incredible resistance to all this, and so what we're up against.
Yeah, it's so huge.
Power,
it really is.
Power of it all, you know, like that.
Yeah.
And just the unwillingness of people, like I say, my friend's wife, who just doesn't want to consider it.
Yeah.
You know, like,
no,
I mean,
people can't.
It's too much. It's too much for a lot of people. You know. You know.
But they can. But they need. But yeah.
Yeah. And it's
over time, more and more people will. It's funny with younger kids. Sometimes it's easy for them. They just see it. It's like. I mean, that's how I learned from my 15-year-old, you know. Anyway, so we need to wind up here,
yep.
Jim. We're coming down. I'm not going to be on the show next week. You're going to interview Robert Bruce about his books on astral travel, planes, and so on. And
yeah.
I'll contact Odin. I hope he'll co-host with you.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Yeah. I didn't mean to get into the political forum today.
Oh, I didn't even think we were going to talk about this today.
It's fun. Well, I hadn't intended to,
yeah.
But it's what my feeling is most about these days, is I really try to watch what's happening on the Internet and to be kept abreast of what's happening in the world. I think it's very serious times. So, so in a month from now, I may be in New Zealand the time after that. I don't know yet because I don't know if I can get there. Or not, because I haven't had the support yet to be able to get to travel there. So I'm